Thank you. My name is Jim W., and I am a very grateful alcoholic. The first time I heard this read was last year at the old timers meeting down at City College, and it was read by a lady who was the widow of Jim B., the original alcoholic who was responsible for having God, as you understand him, put in our chapter 5, or in our big book. And I don't have anything to say about this at all, but I want to pass on to you her comment, and maybe you can see in as I read why she said it. She said, as they went through and started to edit the book, that poor Bill almost got drunk when they were changing his baby. I hope you can bear that thought in mind as I start to read. Chapter 5, How It Works. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our directions. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program, usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. There are such unfortunates. They are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a way of life which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. If you've decided that you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to follow directions. At some of these, you may balk. You may think you can find an easier, softer way, but we doubt if you can. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go absolutely. Remember that you are dealing with alcohol, cunning, baffling, and powerful. Without help, it is too much for you. But there is one who has all power, and that one is God. You must find him now. Half measures will avail you nothing. You stand at the turning point. Throw yourself under his protection and care with complete abandon. Now we think you can take it. So I got so mad there I almost lost my place. All right. Throw yourself under his protection and care with complete abandon. Now we think you can take it. Here are the steps we took, which I suggested as your program of recovery. Number one, we admitted that we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care and direction of God as we understood him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, were entirely willing that God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly on our knees asked him to remove our shortcomings, holding nothing back. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make complete amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our contact with God, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual experience as the result of this course of action, we tried to carry this message to others, especially alcoholics. And to practice these principles in all our affairs. You may exclaim, what an order, I can't go through with it. Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is that we are willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after have been designed to sell you three pertinent ideas. A, that you are an alcoholic and cannot manage your own life. B, that probably no human power can relieve your alcoholism. C, that God can and will. If you are not convinced on these vital issues, you ought to reread the book up to this point or else throw it away. And there's a footnote, that says the other changes in the fifth chapter consist almost entirely of substituting we for you and eliminating the word must several times. For instance, where it now reads, we were now at step three, the original text read, get down on your knees and say to your maker, thank you very much.
It is indeed a pleasure of mine to give you your main banquet speaker for our first annual is Jack B.
Good evening, friend. My name is Jack Brennan. I'm an alcoholic. And I am very happy to be here tonight with you people. I flew in last night from Kansas City, and the plane was 3 hours late because of mechanical difficulties. They had to tie one of the wings back on, and when I tell you I'm very happy to be here tonight, you can believe it. And if there's anybody here that works for TWA, you ought to be ashamed of yourself. You sit on those stupid flying corpses, you know, or flying coffins. You see all them little men running around outside grinning in the windows at you, putting the damn things back together again. I saw a lot of exchanging of money. I think they were taking bets on whether we would make it. I hate to fly. Flying is for the birds, as far as I'm concerned. But when Eddie called, or whoever called, and said, would I come, I have to say yes. Because I owe so much to Alcoholics Anonymous, you see. And I live in Kansas. I'm originally from New York. And I moved to Kansas, and that was a mistake. I'm very happy to be here, to be away from Kansas, too. They're trying to educate me up there. I have a real smart-ass brother-in-law, you know. He owns a lot of cattle, and he keeps taking me out and showing me things and asking me, what is that, Jack? And to me, they're all cows. And when I say a cow, he laughs like crazy. And then one day he told me there's things like bulls, too, you know. So the next time I said, that's a bull. And he said, no, that's a steer. Now I got to find out what the hell a steer is. And it's a very strange place up there, very strange people. They don't talk. They sit down in the restaurant, and the waitress puts their breakfast in front of them. I don't know how the hell they order it. They never say anything. They just sit down. But I'm learning, you know. I get along anywhere, and I'm learning. I learned why they bury cowboys with their boots on, because they can't get them off. That's why, see? And you know why boots are always pointed? That's for stepping on cockroaches in the corners. Yeah? Every time I went into a drugstore, there were people there buying Preparation H. And I asked the druggist one day, I said, how come everybody uses preparation H? Is that because they ride horses? He said, oh, no, no, they don't use it for that. I said, what the hell do they use it for? He said, they use it for people that are losing their hair. I said, you got to be kidding. He said, no. He said, it's wonderful. You rub it on your head if you got a bald head. And I said, does it grow hair? He says, no. He says, it shrinks your head to fit the hair you got. Yeah. There's a lot of people here that can use that information. They got a lot of country western singers up there, you know. And my favorite is Loretta Lynn. And she sings good and she's nice people, you know. And she wrote the Al-Anon theme song. And everywhere I go, they say, Al-Anon hasn't got a theme song. I say, oh, they sure do. And Loretta Lynn wrote it, and she sings it, and the name of it is, Don't Come Home A-Drinking With Lovin' On Your Mind. You know. Now, I'd like to tell you a story about old Pat over in Ireland. Did you see my tie? Take a good look. Oh, my, what a relief. My wife forces me to wear that for the first 3 minutes of my speaking. I have to go to the bathroom, but they won't let me go.
I hate to butt in at this point. We have got a bona fide emergency. Would Sharon Goldsmith or Ray Nobles please come to the main gate up here? Right up here.
I would like to tell you a little story about an alcoholic in Ireland. Ireland is full of them, of course. And his wife, you know, knew nothing about Al-Anon, the poor thing. And she went to the priest one day. She said, Father, he's drunk again. And the priest said, oh, my God, no. And she said, yeah, he's drunk again. And the priest said, well, I don't know what that we're going to do with him. He said, we tried everything. We've tried to scare him. We've tried to do everything with him. And he said, I don't know what to do to keep him sober. And he said, Mary, tell me. He said, the house that you live in is at the foot of a little lane, isn't it? And she said, yes, Father, it is. And he says, there's bushes on either side, right? And she said, yes, there is. He said, well, why don't you tonight put a big sheet over your head and get out into the bushes, you see? And when he comes home, jump out and scare him. Maybe that'll do it this time. So here's her poor soul is out there in the bushes at midnight waiting on himself to come down. And he comes down the road hitting both sides, and she's in the bushes with her sheet over her head. And he comes down the road and he gets within about 15 feet of her. And she jumps out and she waves her hand and she says, "Ee, I'm the devil. And he says, oh, let me shake your hand. I married your sister. Yeah. Well, I said when I stood up here that my name was Jack Brennan, I'm an alcoholic. And my name doesn't mean a damn thing, nothing. But the fact that I'm an alcoholic and I'm standing here talking to you people, it means quite a bit, believe it. Because I should be dead and I'm not. And I'm one of those few privileged people, members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I say few because we are few in number. When we figure 750,000 recovering alcoholics in Alcoholics Anonymous, and we compare that with the 12 or 16 million on the outside that have not yet found this program, then we are very few in number, believe it. And I stand here tonight only because of the grace of a higher power. And my friend upstairs does not love me any better than he loves you. And he does not love anyone any different from anyone else. And he loves us all equally well. And those few of us that are in Alcoholics Anonymous, I say are the fortunate ones, the lucky ones, the miracles, actual miracles. I believe that I'm a miracle. Because without this program of AA, I would not be here, I would be dead. And my name would have been a blight on the face of the earth. Because when I was drinking, I was a maniac. And this is the story of one alcoholic. And not necessarily a story that is severe or terrible. Because you see, alcoholism is a progressive disease. What happened to me could theoretically happen to anyone that's sitting out there. So if you came in a little earlier to this program than I did, that's fine. God bless you. It only proved that AA works better today than it did before. But it does not mean by any means that you have to go the distance that I did. But you can if you want to. The choice is all yours. The most amazing thing always happens to me at these conventions. I sit here and I look out and I see so many people and I wonder who the one individual is that I'm here to speak to tonight. Because I'm not so foolish to think that because I came here everybody is going to benefit. No, not true. But my friend upstairs does not waste time. He does not waste my time. Does not stuff me onto those stupid planes that come down here just for a lark. I'm here for a reason. I'm here because there's one individual sitting out there that has to hear what I have to say. And I'm so grateful to be able to stand here and talk to that one individual. The rest of you can sit there nice and quietly and listen. But that one individual, you listen good, because I don't like flying and I got to go back, you see. I saw a ghost from the past tonight. And when they read that fifth chapter as it used to be, it took my mind way back. And I think of AA, how that it was when I came in. And I think now of how that it's changed. And I think of the growth of AA then and the growth of AA now. They had to be doing something right in the old days, believe it. Because the growth was phenomenal. And there was no easy way. And the alcoholic came into AA because there was no other place to go. It was the last stop. And I say that many of those things that man read here tonight are still true. You must get the attention of the alcoholic and you must drive it home. And they say there are no musts in AA. And I will go along with that to a point. But I say there are a hell of a lot of you damn well betters, you see. And I remember one time long many years ago that I was a dishwasher and a cook. Not the cook, but I made the coffee. In a group in Brooklyn, New York. And it was my early time in AA. And into the meeting came an alcoholic, active, looking for help. And he was a big one. He was a big one. And he was a very disruptive alcoholic, too. And I was about to measure him and dump him. And somebody said, no, we don't do it that way no more, Jack. But the only reason I wanted to keep him around was so that I could help him. But he wouldn't keep his fat mouth shut, don't you see? And he was disrupting a meeting. So I took him into the kitchen where I knew everything in there in the kitchen because that was my domain. I was a coffee maker. And I literally stuffed him under the sink. And I said, now you stay there until the meeting is over and then we'll go home and we'll talk. And lo and behold, I walked in tonight and I ran into that individual. And he sits here tonight and I'm so happy that he's here. And I won't embarrass him by mentioning his name, but that's the way AA works, you see. And I told him that night, if you open your mouth once more, I'll break your back. I was not a very gentle alcoholic, you see. Hey. And people used to say about me that I had lost my coot. And I say, I agree with that. I never had any to lose, you know. I was always very uncouth. But to come here tonight and see you people, see these young people up here in the front row, it's just beautiful. And to be here at the Faith Convention of San Fernando Valley, wonderful. I'm very privileged. And I'll try to talk very quickly here tonight because I know the time is short. I was born an alcoholic. And to be born an alcoholic is, I think, the most horrible thing that can happen to an individual. And yet when we come into AA, it becomes the most beautiful thing. Because you see, the garbage in my past should cause no tears in anyone. If I had my life to live over again, for what that I have today, I would do exactly the same and suffer the same way that I did before I arrived here. Because Alcoholics Anonymous has enabled me to become so close to my friend upstairs and to become useful and wanted and needed in this world. And my definition of spirituality is a person that is needed and wanted and loved. And when I come here to these conventions, I know that I'm wanted and I know that I'm needed. And I can tell by the look in people's faces that they love me and how good that it is. So I consider myself to be, through Alcoholics Anonymous, a spiritual individual. And the garbage that is in the background of my life, my first life before I knew AA, is a very useful tool for other people to look at. And perhaps, like the one individual that sits here tonight, avoid some of the pitfalls that I fell into. I was born an alcoholic, and my father was an alcoholic. And there is the beginning of my tale. Because you see, for the first 12 years of my life, I suffered nothing but ungrounded and unfounded fear. And every time my father came home drunk, I went down and hid behind a boiler because I was terrified of him. And when he sobered up, I loved him just like I loved, like a boy should love his father. But there was always one doubt in my mind. Will what he tell me be true? Will he stop drinking? And I used to be so happy when he would sober up and I would go and tell my mother, Mommy's sober and he's going to be all right. Don't fight anymore, please. And she would say, all right, Jack, we'll see. And 2 weeks later, my father would come home drunk. And I would be dashed again, don't you see, down behind a boiler crying. I was a strange kid. I was one of 9 children. And the other 8 kids in the house never bothered with my father or my mother. Nothing seemed to bother them. They were very normal kids. They went to school and they ate and they slept and they fought and they played games. They grew up. But you see, me, I was different. I was always a round block in a square hole. And while they were sleeping in their beds, I was sitting in the kitchen between my mother and father, trying to keep them from hurting each other while he was drinking. And I remember those nights. I remember them good. I remember sitting and hoping that he would fall asleep in a chair. And I was hoping that she would not say something to upset him some more. And I know what an alcoholic is, and I understand Al-Anon. And I understand Alateen too, because as yet I was not an alcoholic. But you see, things change. When I talk about the disease of alcoholism, I talk about a real, genuine, bona fide disease. It's not just something to say that Alcoholics Anonymous has invented so that the alcoholic can come here and hide behind the disease. No, not true. We suffer from a very real physical disease, and it affects us in a manner that it affected me. It filled me with an unholy terror of what I don't know, ungrounded, unfounded fear, the first and foremost manifestation of the disease of alcoholism. I brought some pieces of paper with me tonight. It's called Speaking of Your Health, the Disease of Alcoholism, and you'll find them on both ends of the platform. It's by Lester Coleman, M.D., and it's reprinted from a Philadelphia newspaper. It's not supposed to be reprinted, of course, but what the hell can they do to me? I mean, it says alcoholism is an actual physical illness, sometimes described as an allergy, because it reflects a lack of tolerance to alcohol. It is not a mental illness. In bouts of excessive drinking commonly produce personality changes in the alcoholic, which are too often mistaken as mental illness. And it goes on to say that the alcoholic differs from other drinkers not by the amount of alcohol he drinks, but by his body's chemical reaction to it. And it goes on further to say that the alcoholic may not want to drink, but he cannot control the impelling drive and perhaps the chemical need for the sustenance of alcohol. And there is no cure. And the only effective treatment is total and permanent abstinence. And it goes on further to say that the members of Alcoholics Anonymous are standing by at all times, waiting for the alcoholic to come into AA so that they can help these people in their torturous struggle to regain strength and health and dignity as human beings. Now that's the whole picture of the disease of alcoholism. And it's very important that people understand what their disease is. Very urgent. Because you see, I thought when I came into AA that I was some kind of a mental case. And it was urgent for me to understand the disease, and I understand it quite well. And I see people come into AA, they're around 3 or 4 years, and they don't understand yet that they are sick people. And that it's not a question of them that they shouldn't drink. It's simply a question that with their physical body, they just damn well can't drink. That's it, period. Now, I didn't know these things as a kid. All I knew that I had a sick father. I thought that he was some kind of a bum or some kind of a moral degenerate, and there was no AA. And when I went to school, I used to be so ashamed because I always sat with my brother's shoes and my brother's pants. And I never had a bicycle. I never had a pair of skates. And I always knew what the trouble was. And I knew why that my mother always cried into our apron when my father was drunk. And my heart went out to that woman, though. And I loved her very dearly, and I learned how to hate my father because of his drinking. I learned definitely how to hate. And when my cousins used to come in with drink and whiskey or wine or beer, whatever it happened to be, and my father would take his first drink, I knew the inevitable result, trouble. I knew that my father and alcohol was trouble. And I cursed my cousins and I cursed my father's friends for bringing it into the house. And yet, I stand here tonight and I tell you that my name is Jack and I'm an alcoholic. And there is no earthly reason for me to stand here. None. Because I hated alcohol. And I hated people that drank. And I saw what it did to my mother. And I watched her arguing with the landlord, pleading for her not to throw us out into the street. And I watched her putting pork chops or meat onto the table and not eating herself, because there was not enough food to go around with an alcoholic husband and she would never eat. And there were the things that I knew. But what other reason could there possibly be for me to stand here and tell you that I'm an alcoholic? There is no earthly reason except one, that I suffer from a disease over which that I have no control. None. My mother died of cancer at a very early age. And she never shook her fist at the sky and cursed God because he saw fit to inflict her with the disease of cancer. But you see, he inflicted me with the disease of alcoholism, and I cursed him. I cursed him every day that I lived after I became an alcoholic, because I thought he had played a dirty trick on me, don't you see? I never ever wanted to be like my father. I never ever wanted to hurt my mother. And I always said that when I grew up, and if I ever had children, they would know a good home. And they would have a bicycle, and they would have skates. And that my icebox or refrigerator would never be empty. There would always be food in it. And they would never worry about a new pair of shoes. But this was not to be, because I am an alcoholic, and I was born that way. And I have no control further than that over it. And I say thank God for Alcoholics Anonymous. And I say thank God for all the people that sit here tonight sober. I can just picture in my mind's eye why the man upstairs would be so good to give to Bill Wilson what was needed to put this program together. The understanding that was given to Bill Wilson by a very loving higher power some 40 years ago in Akron, Ohio. I can understand it. I can understand it really good, why the man upstairs would reach down and give to a certain select group of sick people, alcoholics, when he gave nothing to anyone else. When you have cancer, you die. When you have diabetes, you live with it. You do the best that you can, the doctors help you. But when you're an alcoholic, there is no help. None. And until 40 years ago, and back 3,000 years, there was no help for the alcoholic, nowhere in this world. And I stand here tonight without fear of contradiction, without any fear of contradiction whatsoever. And I will tell you this, that there is still no help anywhere but in AA for the alcoholic. Nowhere. And Bill Wilson told us so very plainly, money is not the answer. Medicine is not the answer. Science is not the answer. And religion is not the answer. And he said it loud and he said it clear, as you heard there in the fifth chapter of the big book. But there is one answer, and that's the higher power. And may you find him now. And that is what works here. That is why that we are miracles. Do you know that for 3,000 years, think of all the alcoholics that were born and died alcoholic without any faith, without any hope. No reason for living whatsoever. Because once you were given the tag of helpless, hopeless, chronic alcoholic, and that was it. It was like having cancer of the stomach or cancer of the lungs or both. There was no hope, nothing. Now I say this, there is hope. There is hope. AA is here. AA was born 40 years ago. And for 3,000 years, can you imagine how many prayers and how many entreaties went up to a higher power or God, as I choose to call him? Help my mother, help my brother, help my sister, help my neighbor, help my wife, help my husband. I think that the higher power must have get ear-tone deaf from listening to them all. And one day he decided, well, I will do something for these people. And I think I know why, too, that he chose us, alcoholics, to be the recipients of his goodness. Because of the little people that we hurt, the children. I believe that with all my heart. Because if I think now in my mind's eye and I look out here at all you people, and how happy that your children must be, that you're in AA, and how their lives are changing, and how they're growing up straight and strong and not warped. And then I think of you people, and myself included, drunk. What a tragedy that it would be. And how many little people then would be hurt again, don't you see? So I believe that the higher power gave us AA in order for us to protect little children and take care of them, you see, as they are supposed to be taken care of. 3,000 years ago, the Chinese gave a perfect description of the disease of alcoholism. 3,000 years ago, in the earliest recorded history, we find a description. And it says that the man takes a drink, and then a drink takes a drink, and then a drink takes the man. And that's a description of alcoholism at 3,000 years old. So the short 40 years that AA has been in existence is really a drop in the bucket. But look at what miracles it has wrought. And I say this, Reach out your hand and touch your neighbor, and you've touched the miracle. Because until then, there was no hope for the alcoholic. I picked up my first drink at age 12. I was in a bedroom with my stupid brother. And my brother knows he's stupid, and I know he's stupid, and we get along really fine. He is just a plain dope, that's all. And we were in a bedroom because my father was on another drunk. And things in the home had disintegrated to the point where I wouldn't even speak to my father. I wouldn't speak to the rest of the family. I was one of those round blocks in a square hole. When I went to school, I sat in the back of the room, I wouldn't open my face. If I knew the answer, I wouldn't say it because I didn't like to be laughed at. And everybody laughed at me. I was always the clown. I did everything wrong. And up until that time, the only thing and only advice anyone had for me was to be like your brother. Be like your brother and you'll be all right. This was my older brother, not the dope. And my older brother was a very nice fella. And he went to school and he got good marks and he spoke very nicely. He always hung his clothes up. He always put one shoe next to the other. He even stopped in church sometimes on Wednesdays. And for me to be like him, alcoholic that I was, impossible. So I hated him too, don't you see? I used to be like my brother. I couldn't be like my brother, so I hated him. Well, this particular day, my dummy brother and I were in the bedroom. And my mother told us to get in there and be quiet. Maybe it wouldn't be too bad this time. But I was looking down the throat of another long weekend, wondering what was going to happen this time. I had a big knot of fear in my belly, you know. And my brother went under the bed and he come up and he said, "Hey, Jack, look what I found. Bottle of wine." I said, "You know what you could do with it." I had no more interest in a bottle of wine than I had in flying on TWA. None. I wouldn't mind if I flew on American Airlines, you know, because it's such a relief. They serve you a cup of coffee and they got a big AA on a cup, you know. Very reassuring, very reassuring. My brother said he opened the bottle and he smelled it. He said, "You know, it smells good. Do you want to try it?" I said, "Hell no." And he said, "I think I will." I said, "Go ahead, stupid." So he tried it. And he said, "Oh, boy, Jack, that's good." And I said, "Really?" And he said, "Yeah, it's good. It's sweet." And I said, "Well, I looked at him for a little bit, don't you see? I wanted to see if he fell down or anything." "Well, he didn't fall down, nothing." And he kept telling me how sweet that it was. I said, "Well, give me that here. Let me see what it's all about." And I took my first drink of wine in the bedroom, age 12, and my brother was 10. And the minute that went down my throat and into my stomach, I knew relief. I knew relief from ungrounded and unfounded fear. Because the knot in my belly disappeared, I straightened up and I said, "My God, that's wonderful stuff. No wonder the old man's always sipping on it, you know." And then I said to my brother, "Why don't you have another one, Joe?" He said, "Yeah, I think I will." And he had another one. He said, "Oh, boy, that's sweet." And I said, "You damn fool, see?" He was talking about what that had tasted like. And I took my second drink. I said, "It's a miracle." And I said, "If the Lord made anything better than that, he must have kept it up there for himself." And I believed it. Because now I could be like my brother, don't you see? I could be like everybody else. And I looked at that bottle and I said, "That's pure magic." And I said to my brother, "Let's have another one." He said, "No, if you drink any more, you're going to get sick." And I said, "You're out of your stupid mind." And I took my third one. And you know something? The next thing that I remember, it was Sunday morning. And my mother was bending over me, and she was crying very bitterly. And she told me, she said, "Jack, Jack, what are you doing? What have you done to me?" And I sat up in bed like a scared deer. And I had that big knot in my stomach of remorse. I knew I had done something. I couldn't figure out what that it was. And I said, "Mom, please stop crying. Tell me what I did." And she said, "You drink almost 3/4 of a gallon of wine. And then I told you to take a bath, and you tried, and you almost drowned in a bathtub because you collapsed. And I looked at her, and I was amazed. And she said, it's Sunday morning, Jack. Get up and go to church. And she said, please promise me that you won't never do that again. She said, one in this family is enough. I can't take two. And I said, if you'll only stop crying, I'll never drink another drop in my life. And I promised her, and I convinced her that what that I was saying was true, and I was lying. I was lying. Because, you know, I remembered that relief that had came to my stomach. And I remembered a feeling of well-being I had with that quick drink. And if St. Peter would have stood next to me, I would have lied to him too. Because now I had gotten a taste. I had gotten a taste of relief. Not wine, not whiskey, not beer. I had gotten a taste of what it was to feel good for the first time in 12 years. I never felt good. I always felt poorly. I always felt frightened. I always felt afraid. I always felt different. I always felt inferior. But with a little wine, I was 10 foot tall and I could do anything. I could be just like my brother. Well, I want to tell you something. I was an Irish Catholic, and I was an altar boy. And if you're wondering how did you get wine at 12 years of age, all you have to do is be an altar boy and an Irish Catholic. And I got the early mass, and I went there at 5:15 for the 6 o'clock mass. And I would go into the sacristy, and I would clean up the sacristy, and I would polish off a few drinks of wine, and I could go to school, and I could talk just like anybody else. And I could answer questions. I used to tell a nun, sister, why don't you sit down in my seat, and I'll take over the class today. And everybody was amazed at the transformation in Stupid Jack, the quiet one. Now I was just equal to everybody in this world. I had a little wine in the sacristy in the morning. But you see, I had problems even then. Because I used to run into alcoholic priests, and they used to get their 4:45. That was a bad day. And then I would go to school like didn't eat a dunce. And I'd sit in the back of it again, they'd ask me a question, I couldn't answer it no more. And that was my life. From that day on, that was my life. I didn't drink because I liked the taste of it. I didn't drink because it was the thing to do. I drank because it made my inferior body, the chemical body that I was suffering the disease of alcoholism, it relieved me. And I could live. And I could be like anybody else in this world. Well, like the Chinese said, you know, man takes a drink, then the drink takes a drink, then the drink takes the man. When I was 16 years of age, my mother came home from early morning shopping and found me in the house after being out all night. And I sat at a table across from my father at cursing. And I was half drunk. And I had a bottle of whiskey. And I had a roll of stolen money. And I had a revolver, 38. And I was telling my father that if he touched one of my dollars or one of my drinks, I would blow the top of his head right off. I was but 16 years of age. Progression of the disease of alcoholism. How did I get involved in nonsense such as that? Very simple. You see, I never had a new pair of shoes. Never had a skates. Never had a bicycle. Never had a new pair of pants. And my father worked like a horse. He was a steam fitter. And when he worked, he went out early in the morning, came home late at night exhausted, and fall into a bed and sleep and do the same thing the next day. And my mother would have to go to a butcher, and she would have to count nickels to feed 9 children. So I came to the conclusion very early in life that work was for horses and fools. And I must admit that sometimes I feel the same way today, you know. But it's the comparison that gets to me, don't you see? So I found what I wanted in this world. I found an easy buck, somebody else's. And if I had a 38 or a 32 revolver in my hand, I was king. I could do anything. And that's just exactly what that I did. Anything. And I don't stand here and tell you that I'm proud, you know, of the things that I did. I'm not. But it happened to me. And it happened to me in a very easy, gentle way. Because the alcoholic is the last one to know. And as long as I had a dollar, that was all that was important to me. And I didn't care where the dollar came from. And I hurt an awful lot of people in this world. I've hurt people very seriously. You see, I ran with a mob on the east side of New York. On the west side of New York, I should say. And they were very nasty people. And I was the wheelman for a mob. And I used to drive a car at 90 and 95 and 100 miles an hour. It weighted down fenders. And I used to lead many, many cops and police on wild goose chases because they could never catch me. They could never catch me because of that souped-up automobile, weights in the fenders. I have watched police cars try to take the same curve that I would, and they never made it and went off into the woods, into the highway, and crashed. I've been shot. I've been stabbed. I have shot people, and I'm not proud. All I can say to you, the one saving thing that I can say to you in defense of the life that I led. I was suffering from a disease over which that I had no control. And it's like the good doctor said here in this piece of paper, too many times mistaken as mental illness, but the alcoholic returns to sobriety, the craziness disappears. But you see, when I went to bed, no matter where that it was, how long that I slept, I would wake up. I was always a 12-year-old scared kid. I would sit and I would wake up in the morning and I'd feel for my gun and I would smell it. And I would feel in my pockets for money. And then I would sit on the end of a bed and I would cry. And I would cry inside mostly, sometimes outside too. And I would sit there and I would cry and I would shudder and I would curse myself because I never ever wanted to do what that I was doing. And then necessarily to bury the 12-year-old scared kid, I would reach under my bed and I always had a bottle. That was my only relief. And I would take a drink and I would bury that 12-year-old scared kid. And with that first drink, I would be able to go out and do the same thing the next night that I had done the night before. So I lived a life like a yo-yo, up and down, a madman at night, bashing people over the bridge of the nose with a gun after stealing their money, sticking a gun into a man's belly and laughing at him when he showed the fear and his mouth would fall open with horror. And I can still see in my mind's eye many nights when I wake up in the middle of the night and I relive one of these moments, don't you see? Now I sit on the end of my bed and I think back and I see guys with blood coming out of the corner of his eyes and me standing laughing at him. And it's like I look at two other people. And it's the nights that I sit on a bed and I don't no more cry. But I sit and I thank God for AA and the 12 steps of AA that enabled me to change my life and to be able to come here and stand and talk to you people and be an example of what Alcoholics Anonymous can do. Not me. By myself, I am completely helpless and hopeless. And if it weren't for this program and a very ever-loving, gentle higher power who saw fit to draw me back from my own grave I would be useless and nothing. Because I was hated and I was despised wherever that I went. And the progression of alcohol is a tremendous thing. And I say that too, that here in AA we have a progression of sobriety. And that's why we must ever, always be mindful of the 12 steps and put them into our life to the best of our ability. And the name of the game is change. If I were the same individual that came into AA 29 years ago, I would cut my throat. I couldn't stand the stink of me. But you see, AA and the 12 steps enabled me to do what doctors and scientists and ministers and priests could not do. They gave me my life back in the center of my hand and told me, hang on to your sponsor, and do exactly that he tells you, and you'll be all right and things will get better. And I had faith enough to believe. And that's what I came tonight to tell that one individual. If I can do it, you can damn well do it too. If I can do it, anybody can do it. And I would say at this point that if you have enough guts, that you can move a mountain with a spoon. If you have enough guts and enough courage and enough stamina to at least try. You see, I thought that my life always would be money and fast living and fast cars. But the man takes a drink, and the drink takes a drink, and the drink takes the man. I came down from a morning in a hotel room one day after a night on the outside sticking up a nightclub. And I came down with my usual fears. And not knowing what had gone on the night before. And I started to put the night together. And I started to put the night together by asking stupid questions, you know. And I was with a rough bunch of people. And I came down, and you can picture it. Here's the wheelman, the driver of the car, coming down asking everybody, how did it go last night? Well, I don't blame them for being a little shook up, you know. And he said to me, Jack, you know, you drove the car, you ought to know. And I said, well, I was a little busy last night. And they told me that day, they said, you know why don't we call you what we do? And my name was Crazy Jack, the Umbriago. Umbriago, just in case you don't know what it means, is Italian. And it means drunkard. Crazy Jack the drunkard. Give him a drink and see what he'll do next. And that's the way that it was. And he told me that day, they said, Jack, we think that maybe you were having a little trouble with alcohol. And they said, you know, my friend, it would be a tragedy one night that instead of taking us home, you took us to a police station, you know. And I had to agree with them. I had to agree with them. So that was the first time that I lost a job on account of alcohol. Yes.
I hate to break into that again, but there's three cars out here that they are prepared to tow away unless you want to move them. License number 881KJD, YPC192, and 4877JE.
If they tow them away, Sue. Supreme Court has decided that it's illegal to tow another person's car. I lost my first job and I went out on my own. And I figured I was going to whip the world, you know. I have a long police record. I've been arrested over 125 times. I've done time in two state prisons. Not too much, but enough. I could never ever make a move on my own. And you know, people all along the way tried to help me. Social workers, priests, ministers, doctors, everybody tried to help me. They would come into wherever I happened to be, and they would say, Jack, you are too nice and young fella, you know, to be locked up here. And I would say, well, you know, that's the way it happened. You win a few and you lose a few. They would say, yeah, but you've been losing them right steady for a long time. And I had to admit that was true, but I would always say, well, when I get out, you know, things will be different. I'll make a good score and I'll be all right. And they would say, but we want to help you. And I would say, well, how do you want to help me? And they all had the same story. Stop drinking and we can help you. And the moment that they said, stop drinking, I would say, get the hell out of here and leave me alone. Because I couldn't stop drinking. Who needed to be a 12-year-old scared kid? And that's all that I was when I didn't drink. So I would just chase them and I went my merry way and I had a lot of trouble. Had a lot of trouble because, you know, it was catching up with me and I didn't see it. You know, I knew one time in Baltimore where there was a big payroll and a cash checking outfit on a Friday. And I said, I'll go down there and I'll knock that one off, see. And I did. The only problem was that I got there on Thursday. And all I got was about $40 out of the register, you know. And then I went another time in Philadelphia. And I knew where there was a mob that ran an afternoon game, you know, behind the bar. And I said, I'll stick that joint up. They can't holler too much. They're illegal, too, see. So I went down there and I lined everybody up against the wall. And I emptied about 40 guys out of everything they had, watches, rings, everything. And I said, now if you stick your face out of the door for the next 20 minutes, I'll blow a hole right in the top of your head. And I left, and I laughed, you know. But if you've never been in Philadelphia, don't go. Don't go. It's a bad town, I tell you. It's all one-way streets. And I got in my car, stolen car that it was, and I took off very nicely, had a big brown paper bag with all the loot in it, and I was laughing to myself. And I went up to the corner with a one-way street. I made the right turn, you know. And I went in another turn, another one-way street. And about 5 minutes later, I was coming back past the same joint. And there was a big fat cop standing in the middle of the street. And he said, all right, get that car out of here. We just had a stick-up. And I said, oh, my. And I took off. And I went up to the corner. And I went around the corner, and we started the one-way street again. And as far as I know, that car is still sitting there. Because I got out, and a big shot from New York made his getaway on a trolley car. Yeah. It's laughable. It's laughable. But I want to tell you, it was not laughable to me. Because I knew there was something wrong. I knew, just as sure as God made little apples, that something was wrong. I never ever wanted to be that way. I never wanted to do the things that I was doing. But every time that I would look at that 12-year-old scared kid in the morning, I would say, no, I can't be like that. And I would go back and do some more and go down a little deeper. I'll make a long story short. I got married. I had a very lovely, naive wife. She thought that my friends were very fine people. She loved to go out to nightclubs and she loved to go dancing. She never knew that when I took her home after a night out, that I would go up on 8th Avenue, up to the Greek joints. I would gamble all night and drink all night. And about 2 o'clock the next afternoon, I would be poured into a bed somewhere. She never knew the things that I was doing after I left her. She thought I was a nice guy, you know. A little erratic, but nice. A lot of fun. Barrel of fun. And one day we got married. And we got married and I was drunk. And she thought that it was quite funny to be drunk at your own wedding, you know. And I was just in a normal state. Drunk. Period. That was it. I was drunk all the time. And one day she said to me, about 3 months after I got married, she said to me, Jack, do you ever work? And I looked at her, I said, you're a lovely kid, you know. You're nice. But don't ever mention that word to me. And they said, as long as you got money, don't mention work. Don't ask questions. You're too damn nosy. And then she'd say, Jack, you know, I used to think that when we went out, you got drunk, it was all right because you went home and sleep. But now I see that you drink around the clock. When do you ever sober up? And I told her, I said, well, when I married you, I was drunk. You had no complaints. Why not? He wanted to change me. She had no answer. And then we had a little boy, you see. And then she started talking about me going to work and me doing this and me doing that. I had to get away from her. I had to get away. She was getting too near the truth. And I couldn't let nobody see me. And I hated to get up in the morning and run in the bathroom, reach in the toilet tank and pull out a bottle of booze and take a drink and sneak it. I couldn't do that, you see. And every time I felt guilty, I'd take a drink in front of her, I would die. I didn't want nobody to know that what my brother had said was true. I was more like my father every day. Only I had passed my father like he's standing still. My father never hurt anybody. It was a rough day. And that day at 16, when my mother turned around and took me by the back of the neck and my bottle of whiskey and my stolen money and my gun and threw me out of the house and told me don't come back. And she preferred him over me because she told me, she said, he's never hurt anybody but you. You hurt everybody ever come in contact with. Now here I was with my wife and married and with a little boy, and my wife was looking at me the same way. So I left and I went to sea, and I got hurt. I got hurt pretty badly. I got torpedoed 3 times. And I never ever wanted to go home. Never. I used to meet my wife somewhere away in New York or New Jersey and drink all night, and I'd leave the next day. You know, I would never stay home. Now I was forced to come home. I spent 3 months in a hospital recovering. And when I was taken out of the hospital, I was put into a Red Cross ambulance and taken home and deposited in Brooklyn on my wife's doorstep. Now I knew that my secret was out. And I went upstairs to an apartment I had never been in. And I told my wife, give me a drink. And she said, Jack, I don't have anything to drink. I live here with my son and I don't have anything. I said, well, you better hurry up and get some. Go downstairs and get a bottle and come back. When she came back with the bottle, I told her, I said, now, take that kid. Take him over to your mother's and stay there till I call you. He makes too damn much noise. He's always crying. And I sat in Brooklyn, and I looked out of a bedroom window, and I drank. Because I didn't know what else to do. And I drank around the clock. And when one bottle was through, I would reach out and I would get another one. And one day she came up to me and she was crying and she said, Jack, I can't take no more. She said, you're killing yourself with booze and I'm going to do something about it. I'm going to help you. And I said, you're just like everybody else in this whole world. You won't leave me alone. I said, I've told you 1,000 times. I can't stop drinking. When I stop drinking, I'm nothing. I have to drink in order to live. Don't you understand that? And I say, you want to snatch my booze away from me. Everybody wants to take my booze. And my booze is my only friend. Why don't you leave me be? And she said, it's not true. I'm your friend. I say, you're nothing to me. Nothing. All you are is a big millstone around my neck. With your crying and with your screaming and howling all the time about you. And why don't you just leave me? And she said, I can't. You're my husband. And she said, my son here needs a father, and you're it. She said, I'm going to help you whether you want me to or not. I said, you do, and I'll kill you. Stay away from me. Leave me be. Well, she helped me. One day, she came back, and she gave me the big book of AA, and I threw it through the window. And I told her, I said, if you come near me again with that stuff, I'll throw you through the window. Keep away from me. Just leave me be. That was my cry. Leave me alone. I can handle it myself. And I was convinced that one day, somehow, I was going to find a way to drink. And I was going to be able to take two drinks and go home just like my brother. That's all that I wanted to do. I couldn't leave it alone completely because I needed the relief in my stomach. I needed to be like other people, so I had to drink. Well, one day I went out. She wouldn't bring me any more booze in, and I had to go out. And I went out, and I went to my favorite bar, and I asked for a drink, and a man almost died. He said, "Jack, get out of my bar." And I said, "What's wrong with you?" And he said, "I'll tell you what's wrong with me. Your wife was here this morning, and she told me that if I even give you one drink today, that she's going to set fire to my bar tonight." And I said, "She has gone berserk. She's gone crazy." I went to a delicatessen. She had been there too. I couldn't even get a can of beer, nothing. She shut me off all over Brooklyn. And I went home and I said, "I'm going to kill you." And she said, "Wait just a minute. Before that you kill me, what is it that you want?" And I said, "You know damn well what I want. I need a drink. I'm dying." She said, "Do you need a drink? I'll buy you a drink." And I said to her, I said, "Who do you want killed?" Because she wouldn't buy me a drink, I don't think. And I said, "Impossible." She said, "No. If you want a drink, I'll buy you a drink. But will you go to New York with me?" Well, now that was a big trip to New York from Brooklyn to Manhattan. You had to get on the subway underground. I wasn't ready for that, you know. And I said, "That's a pretty rough bit." And she said, "If you want a drink bad enough, you'll go." I said, "Okay, I'll go." So I got on the subway for a drink. And I went to New York, and I was in such bad shape when I got there, she said, "I better buy you another one." So she bought me another one. And I said, "Now what happens?" She said, "Now we're going into that church over there." And I said, "No, not me. I don't go in that church. That's a Protestant church, and I'm an Irish Catholic." And she said, "You are a drunken bum. And you haven't been in any church for over 20 years, and you promised me, and you better go." So I went. And I said, "What is it all about?" She said, "It's AA. They're going to help you." I said, "Oh, another one of those things." I said, "Okay." So I came into a room, and it was an idiot up here like I am up here tonight. And you know, I sat in the back, and I said, "Hurry up and help me, because I'm very shaky." And, you know, this guy started talking, and I said, "Listen," I said, "Oh, boy, listen to this nonsense." Then he got to one point in his story, and I couldn't tolerate it. You know what he said? "Don't take the first drink, and you won't get drunk." And I said, "You son of a bitch. If I get close enough to you, I'll kill you." And I give my wife a jab in the ribs. I said, "I knew that in Brooklyn. I didn't have to come here to hear that." And I got out of there just before the cops arrived. I broke up the meeting. And I said to my wife on the sidewalk, "If ever I step foot in another AA meeting, I will be dead." And you know something? I almost made it. I missed it just by a scant hair of being dead when I came back. See, I left there that day, and my wife drew the line. She said, "All right, big shot. I've tried everything. Everything." Now, she says, "I have two kids. I have two children now. And a little girl." And she said, "They are going to live. And you, if you are not an alcoholic, then you better start performing as a husband. And the first time that you step over the line, watch me, because I'm going to straighten you out." And I laughed. I said, you scare me. Something terrible. I said, "You wouldn't do that to me, would you?" And she said, "Watch me." I said, "How come that you're so changed, you know?" She said, "Well, I had a good teacher. All the rotten, filthy things that I know, you taught me." And she said, "Now, I'm going to straighten you out, Jack, and you best believe it." and I laughed. But I didn't laugh too long. Because I came home a couple of 3 days later, I thought, and there was two cops sitting in my apartment. Now, if there's any cops here tonight, peace. I am an honorary policeman in six states, and I got badges to prove it, so I'm with you fellas. And if you start any trouble, I might lock you up. I came home and these two cops were sitting in my apartment and I said, what do you do here? I didn't say that, of course, you know, but there's too many people here tonight. And I said, this is my castle. And I don't like you people, so get out. And they wouldn't go. So I threw them. They were there because my wife had called them. It seems I had come home the night before and I was strangling her. I thought I was fighting a war again, don't you see? She showed me the marks on her throat. And I said, oh, that's between you and me, not them. Out. They wouldn't go, so I threw them out. And they got reinforcements, and they came back. Then they threw me out. And they did it in a very unique manner. They put handcuffs on me, and they said, we're going in. And I said, okay. And I said, but why don't you first give me a little chance, you know, to straighten you out? And they didn't like that idea, and they knocked me down. Well, while I was down, they grabbed me by my heels, and they dragged me down by my heels from the sixth floor. And we had marble steps, and my head hit every step on the way down. And when we got down to the bottom, they said to me, are you still a tough guy? And I said, yeah, even more so now. And they said to me, well, what do you want to do about it? And I said, well, take these handcuffs off for just 5 minutes, and I'll be a very happy fellow. And they did. And we went out in the back of that building, and we went round and round. And I remember getting clubbed to the ground, and I remember getting up, and I remember getting bounced off walls, and I remember getting in a few good licks. And then I remember, too, at one point where a big sergeant was kneeling on my chest and holding me. And he was almost crying. And he said, please, kid, don't get up no more. If you get up, we're going to have to kill you. And I said, that's right. That's what you're going to have to do. Because you can't do that to me, see. And I got up again, and I got knocked down again. And the next thing you know, I was laying on a table in a straitjacket in Kings County Hospital in Brooklyn, and I had a fractured skull, and all my ribs were caved in, and I had stitches in every part of my body, and 5 fingers on my right hand were broken, my both jaws were wired together, and I couldn't see out of my eyes, and I had a big lump of blood at the back of my throat, and I couldn't spit it out because my jaws were wired together. And I lay there and I cried, and I was 12 years old and I was scared, and I said, my God, what am I doing? And I said, if I ever get out of here, I go drink no more. That's it. I've had it. And they let me out at a respectable period of time, 20 days, 25 days. And I went home at night because I was so ashamed. And I sat down in the kitchen and my wife said to me, Jack, what are you going to do? I said, I don't know.